everyone. Welcome all. Step right up. Step right up, ladies and gentlemen. Portal Gaming Podcast, episode number 88. Together, we can rule the galaxy.
That sounds more like the Emperor than Darth Vader.
But that's okay. There we go. Now we got my Vader on. Howdy, everybody. My name is DeBrant. You are listening to the Portal Gaming Podcast, which is a product of the store, of a store called The Portal, located in Manchester, Connecticut. For more information, you can log on to www.timemachineportal.com. You can check us out on Facebook, The Portal, and on Twitter, at PortalGaming60. This podcast is a proud member of the Dice Tower Network, and we are excited about that. Hello, everybody. How are you? If you live in Connecticut, I hope you survived the recent storms. I guess there were two tornadoes that touched down in Connecticut, they're saying, this week. I know the storms were crazy, too, aside from just tornadoes in certain spots. I know Eric Summer got knocked out again from Dice Tower tonight. And down there, so I told him he needs to move to Eastern Connecticut because he's kind of Southwest Connecticut and protect himself there. So there you go. Hey, we are excited to bring you this episode. Actually, I'm excited because it's just me. I am in the car at Zephyr's dance class and doing this episode for you. There's my window. I'm going to crack my window a little bit so it doesn't get too hot in here. Do the same. Don't even leave your pets in the car. That's craziness to me. All right. So, yeah, bringing you this episode from the car. Live from the car. we purchased our Dice Tower Con tickets. Nope, sorry. We purchased our flights to get down there. So Kathy, Zephra, and myself will all be appearing at Dice Tower Con this year. So if that is a place that you will be, definitely come and find us, play a game with us, etc. I'm not sure how many hours Zephyr's going to be around and Kathy's going to kind of be with her, but I will be there for a bunch, very specifically, helping out, hopefully helping more with Dice Tower Awards, because that's been really fun and the nominations went up and all that, so I'll do that. Also trying to put together a little music at Dice Tower Con. Kathy and I are both musicians, and there's a bunch of Dice Tower contributors that are musicians, and I said, let's get together and sing. I don't know, maybe we'll do song parodies, because Ambi does that well. Dave Luza writes his own original pieces. Kathy and I just sing and play music, so and there was a couple other people who were interested. So we'll see what happens. I think that's going to be more a little impromptu, but that should be a fun time, so we'll be doing that, but that should be exciting. Upcoming episodes, we're going to have Brian. We're going to do a review. I know that Brian wants to talk about Altiplano. I know Kathy wants to talk about Altiplano. If I can merge the world and get us all together at once, we'll do a review of that. And we've got a review from Zephra on this podcast. So stay tuned for that. Zephra is back. So that should be exciting. Really been picking up on the demos and review copies, so feel like you should find a lot more if you come to the store and you're looking for things to play. On that note, I'm going to talk about rule books. That was my whole Rule the Galaxy for the title on that front. So we shall see how that goes. But yeah, we've been picking up a lot more of those. So hopefully there'll be a lot more reviews coming of more things. For a while, it was, no, we don't have anything for you. No, we don't have anything for you. And lately, a lot of companies have been sending me games. So that's been really good. They don't owe it to me by any means, but we always appreciate them. And anything we can get to you, you know, as it's coming out, before it's coming out, or just after it comes out, I think is important for people making purchasing decisions. Not that games that are a year, 2, 5, 10 years old are bad. They're great. But I know people are always interested in what's coming out and what's next. So we want to keep you informed on that front. There. Hey, Spiel des Jahres and Kinderspiel des Jahres and Kennerspiel des Jahres games were all announced. I don't remember them all specifically, but definitely want to be checking out those. It was kind of an interesting crop. I know Azul and The Mind were two in the Spiel. Azul's definitely a front runner. Oh, the other one's Luxor. Luxor's on Kickstarter now. Man, that's got to be a great time to be a Kickstarter game when you just got a nomination for a major award. People are just going to flood all over that thing. So hopefully I'll get to play these at Dice Tower Con. No, I've played Azul.
I think I'm actually playing the mine tonight. So Luxor, hopefully I'll get to play there. Kenner was kind of crazy. It was like Gonshan. I can't even remember what it's called. They're all very German titles because they don't have English publication yet. But one is a roll and write, a really hefty roll and write, I guess. And another one's kind of a push your luck style management game. Quidling Quackenberg. D. Quidling. I don't remember. And what was the other one? And oh, Heaven and Ale, which I've played and I love. So that would be my front runner now, but it's not really fair given that I haven't played the other two. Roll and Writes are interesting. Interesting to see where these go. I think on the latest Dice Tower, they were talking about Roll and Writes, and Tom was saying he thinks they're going to hit a wall at some point, and I definitely think I agree. I love the concept of Roll and Write, but there comes a point I don't need to play games that 20 people can play simultaneously all the time, but to each his own. If that's what you're looking for, then that's it. So, yeah, we'll keep an eye on those. I don't remember the Kinderspiel games, but I know that is definitely something people are looking for with kids' games and whatnot, so we'll just kind of stay with all that and whatnot. Sorry, I should probably have that information on me, but like I said, I'm sitting in the car, and so I'm just kind of stream of consciousness talking about things as I remember them, a little different from when I have things kind of figured out. So, yeah, all that's what's happening and what's going on. I know June 23rd is the next Silk City Board Game Group, so definitely want to check that out. They're going to do a bunch of music theme. The Record game is going to be there and some other music and programming-oriented games, so that should be really exciting. Yeah, let's move on. So I'm going to review. I'm not going to review Altiplano, but I'll give you two reviews here. So I'm going to talk about Grim Forest. So Grim Forest is a game from Druid City Games, and it is based on Grimm's Fairy Tales, or the Book of Fairy Tales there. And so what happens in this game is it's a very family-oriented game, and what you do on your turn is you pick, where do you want to go to the market? Do you want to get straw? Do you want to get wood? Or do you want to get brick? And you pick which one you're going to go to. There's 5, 4, and 3 resources. So brick is not as plentiful. Straw is the most plentiful. But of course that means more people might go there. So you got to pick. And then you pick a card secretly, flip it over, and everybody travels to that spot. And you split the resources, leaving any remainder there. So that's kind of how that works. So you're trying to figure out. And I believe when you play with 4 players, there's a fourth. There's a market that has one of each. So you could kind of go there. And then, of course, anything will stay, so it'll build up over time in terms of what you're doing. So that's what you do. And then once you get there, you get 2 actions. You collect the resources there, and then you can gain another resource or you can build. So your main thing is you're trying to build. And so I think it takes 2 to build the base of a house, 4 resources to build the walls, and 6 to build the roof. Your goal is to build 3 houses. The first person to build 3 houses wins. At the end of the round, there's some tiebreakers. And they all have to be the same resources. So 2 wood, 2 brick, or 2 straw, and then you have to add wood to a wood house, etc. So what is interesting, where the game goes from there, once you build the walls, you get a friend. So you draw from the friend deck, and you get, you know, the genie from the lamp, or you get, Cinderella's fairy godmother, whatever it is, things like characters like this. And they give you special abilities. Of course, if you draw one, you already have one, you could either replace or you could pass yours to another player, and then they have that friend as well. And then you can draw these fable cards, which are all sorts of things. Go to a space and don't share with the person there, or put a wolf out on a space who scares everybody away and eats up all the resources. All sorts of things. There's a whole deck of fable cards, which are where all the interaction comes in. So the first time I played this, we didn't have as much of the interaction and the cards, because I had played with my mother-in-law and daughter, Zephra. And they were a little weary on taking the cards, but then I got a chance to play it with some gamers, and we were definitely taking a lot more of the cards, and that's where the game is at. So it's a pretty fun game. The production is crazy good. It's got the specialized trays for holding all the things and plastic pieces and all this really nice stuff. So it's really fancy on that front, which is nice. I think it's like a $50 price point, so
you know, the game is pretty light, but the production is a little bit heavier there. It's very nice. You've got all these models that sometimes you don't even use in the game for wolves and various creatures, and everybody gets a mini for them. So, you know, you kind of find your balance, like, but it's a great family game, really intriguing. There's a couple of interesting interactions, but I found it fun to play with gamers. I mean, it wasn't something I wanted to play every time, but it was fun enough that it was interesting, and you're definitely making choices, which is key to me, to make, you know, to make it kind of worthwhile. Not that you always have to do that, but for the most part, that's what I want to do, and to play that with a family. So, yeah, I really liked Grim Forest. I thought it was fun. I think, you know, the replayability might not quite be there, but you got those cards that'll change things up enough. And the game is quick. It's like 25 minutes. It's super fast. You could go from there. You could extend it to 5 houses if you wanted to be longer, although I think it would just kind of start to drone on a little bit. So, yeah, good game for the time frame. So that's Grim Forest from Druid City Games. And then I got a chance to play the Arkham Horror LCG again, solo. And so the Arkham Horror LCG is you get a deck of cards and you construct it yourself. And then you kind of go on a mission. You're in your study and suddenly the door disappears and, you know, chaos abounds, Cthulhu and all that madness. And you've got to investigate. And so that's kind of your main thing is you've got your character and you've got some cards that are locations and you can move around and you can spend actions and resources to play cards and investigate, and there's kind of a story that you're moving through here. It was fun. I really still find, like, that investigation or whatever it is based on each one, there's a really strong thing you're trying to be able to do. And so then you draw from this pool of tokens, and you can change the pool of tokens. So they're anywhere from, like, +2 to -4, and a bunch of symbols that might do things based on conditions. Every scenario has different, you know, to tell you what those symbols do. And so you're trying to kind of figure that piece out. So you're working your way through there. So, yeah, it's really interesting, but those tokens are brutal. Like, you're like, okay, well, I'm one over. I can't add anything, but I must investigate. I cannot move on until I investigate. And you draw, and you draw -2, and you're below, and you fail. You've got to get that threshold. And so it's just kind of luck of the draw there sometimes. And that kind of output randomness where it's like, okay, I'm going to make this decision and then see what happens. It's fun. It's interesting when it works out, but it can be a little bit frustrating. And then like, well, let me reset and reshuffle my deck. So in comparison here to Lord of the Rings LCG, which I talked about in episode 1 of the podcast and how much I love that game, I really think that is the main difference between these two. Lord of the Rings is definitely heavier. It's probably a little more overwrought. There's more things that happen. There's a travel phase. Traveling's not just an action. You have to actually, like, progress through things. And the combat is definitely more complex there, and there's a lot more. But I feel like you have more options in Lord of the Rings, and that's what I really like. And there's definitely randomness, but I feel like the main debate, the main thing comes down to input versus output randomness. In Lord of the Rings, you say, okay, we're questing now, and you draw some cards, and it could change what happens, but for the most part, they're just things that get in your way, or that change how you have to think, and then you get a chance to react to them. Now, I've got thousands of Lord of the Rings LCG cards, and I've got 100 Arkham Horror cards. So, no doubt it's not really a fair comparison. Maybe if I built a deck that was much more equipped like one of my Lord of the Rings decks for Arkham Horror, I would be able to deal with a lot more things, to deal with that investigation, to react to things. So, I want to be careful. No doubt, if you like the Arkham Horror theme, the Arkham Horror card game is hands down going to be your favorite. I know a lot of people like Lord of the Rings. It is definitely a heavier game. It appeals to heavy gamers. It's probably a lifestyle game. I haven't gotten to it as much, although I did dig all my cards out and go through everything again. But what I like about either of these co-op is you can totally, since they are co-op, you can totally collect them as you go. Nothing says when that new pack comes out, it needs to be in your hand. I mean, there's definitely that element, I also realize I am not of that ilk. I am not a collector. So if I don't have something, it's fine with me. Whereas other people are like, oh, that exists, so it needs to be in my collection. So you've got to kind of make that decision. But I definitely think Arkham Horror is a streamlined version. I think that's going to appeal to people. It's a little bit quicker. I imagine you can play this with 2 and 3 people probably in 30 to 45 minutes. Lord of the Rings can stretch out sometimes to over an hour. And don't get me wrong. There are times I'm playing Lord of the Rings LCG, especially when you play solo one-handed, where you just start drawing enemies and cards and you're like, well, I'm dead. You pick up and you shuffle and restart. So I don't want to stand up here and try to defend what's one of my favorite games of all time versus this new runner and be like, oh, this one's no good because this is my favorite all time. They definitely both have that randomness that's always going to be in a card game. That's the fun of constructing a deck, is to try to build a deck that can mitigate and deal with all that stuff. And that's where chaos is super fun. Like, oh, now we got to think about this. But again, in Arkham Horror, sometimes it felt like I just had to shrug and draw one of those tiles and hoped it worked. Whereas in Lord of the Rings LCG, I'd draw cards and then go, how am I going to deal with this now and make decisions from there? And I like that piece a little bit better. I also adore the combat in Lord of the Rings LCG, where you have to choose to defend, quest, or attack, and trying to figure that out and parse all that out, and what can I do, and having another person who can block for you and fire across the way to attack your enemies, I think is just awesome. So that's kind of a comparison of those two, but definitely I think they're both really good. If you're a solo gamer, like, these feel like must-have. Pick a theme. Lord of the Rings, Arkham Horror, run with it. I think you're going to like either one. And honestly, with Lord of the Rings, like, buy into that starter set. It's not the best starter set. You don't really need two. I think there's some cards in there that are really good. I know there's some of the feints and some of the other cards that are pretty key. You could definitely get two and be a little bit better off. But then just buy packs that are cards that are interesting. If you want Bilbo, if you want, a different... a Frodo or something, like, go buy those packs that have those characters and get them in your deck. I don't think you need to buy them in order. Again, I'm not a collector, so it's hard for me to do that, but just pick up the things that interest you and use those. And same with Arkham Horror. You know, there's not as much to buy in Arkham Horror right now. There's also some nice upgrading that happens in Arkham Horror, and they where when I beat a quest, I get experience points, and then I can get, like, better cards that I can put in my deck. They did this with Lord of the Rings when they made the Saga expansions. So you could even do that. I would even suggest that with Lord of the Rings. Get the core and then start with those Saga expansions. I think Black Riders might be the first of that. And play through that and you actually build up your decks as you go. And that actually plays through the Lord of the Rings story as opposed to this periphery stuff that they created in the regular game. So anyway, either way, those are wonderful LCGs. To me, they really appeal to board gamers and solo gamers. They're just kind of on your own clock. So I think those are really good options for those. So that is my review. Arkham Horror, I suppose also Lord of the Rings LCG from Fantasy Flight Games. Both are really, really good. Lord of the Rings, the better for my money. Good intro. All right, everybody. I am here with Zephra, who is back on the podcast. I am so excited. By popular demand, people have been asking for the Zephra segment again. Are you excited to be back, Zephra?
Yes.
Awesome. So you've got a game for us today. What is the name of the game that you want to talk about?
Sunday Split.
Awesome. So Sunday Split is a game from Nate Bivens and Renegade Games. Tell us about Sunday Split. How do we play Sunday Split?
So, there's bananas, cherries, scoops of ice cream, whipped cream, sprinkles, and vegetable card, which give you minus the points, and...
Yep, so it's a card game, right?
Yeah.
And what do we do on a turn? We do what with the cards?
It depends on how many people there are, but you're going to get your cards and you're going to split them up. And you're going to put some cards face down. And then one person has to choose a pile. And then the person who, and then if there's other people, they choose, and then the person who split them gets the last pile. And then it's the next player's turn.
Nice, and so you're trying to pick a pile that's going to score you the most points based on what you're trying to collect, right?
Yeah, but sometimes it's hard because like they're all face down or something, so.
All right, so what do you think about this game? Don't like it?
I really like it.
Awesome. And do you play it mostly with kids or mostly with adults?
I play it mostly with adults.
And do you think it's a kids game, an adult game, or an everybody game?
Everybody game.
Cool. What else do you think about Sunday Split? What else do you want to tell us?
I think it's cool how it has like the bananas and the cherries and the ice cream and the whipped cream and sprinkles. And I kind of like the pictures too. Oh yeah, and also I like how there can be a double scoop which gives you 2 points and just a single scoop that gives you one.
Nice. So you would recommend this game?
Yeah.
Should people try it before they buy it, or do you think they would just go buy it and they would like it?
I think that they should try it before they do it.
Yeah, what do you think somebody wouldn't like in this game?
I think it how like the strawberries and the strawberry ice cream and the chocolate ice cream and the vanilla ice cream give you only up to 2 points, and then the broccoli and all the vegetables either give you -3, -2, or -1. So I think that the points should go up a little bit higher.
Okay. And what do you think people will love about this game? What's like the best part of this game? What's the most fun?
Just playing the game.
Making the pile?
No.
Just playing the game.
Yeah.
The whole thing, fun start to finish. Awesome, Zeph. Welcome back to the Zephra Reviews segment. We are glad to have you back. You want to say bye?
Bye.
All right, everybody, I am back. I am no longer at Zephra's dance class. I am home, and it is a few days later. Had a lot going on, so I didn't have a chance to finish up the episode here. So, I wanted to chime in on board game rule books here for a little bit. So, if you didn't see, there was recently a post on Board Game Geek from the Spiel nominee people talking about bad rule books and how they, you know, it's hard for them to recommend a game to a group of people if they're going to get the game and open it up and the rule book is really tricky for people to understand because, you know, when you give an award or you tell people about a game but you're not there present to teach them the game, it could really be a kind of a bad move to be like, hey, learn this game, but actually you can't learn the game, so call me up, or, you know, and when you're a committee, that's a lot harder, so that's kind of where they're going with that. So I figured I'd throw my two cents in as somebody who reads so many rule books and teaches so many games. I would say, I'm probably about 95% of the games that I play, I learn and I teach. I guess maybe when I go to conventions that would lower because I tend to demo a lot of games, so I might be a little lower based on how many conventions I go to in a year and whatnot. But other than that, I tend to learn and teach most of the games that I play. I love doing it, so I don't have an issue. So my first overall, just, you know, looking at rule books in general, is just that most rule books are solid. I do feel like, for the most part, many of the games that I open up, that I play, I read the rule book, I understand the game, I know how to play it. Usually can look up a rule in there on a second play, or, you know, for a second play can go back to clarify rules that we got wrong. I think that's a really important element for people to understand. Like, you're going to get something wrong the first time you play a game. You're learning how to do something new. Even if that game is similar to something else, you're looking for the differences. In fact, you know, playing Altiplano after playing Orleans and saying, oh, these are the same. Well, they are, but they're also different. Gaia Project and Terra Mystica, they're the same, but they're also different. Even just an expansion to a game, or a new addition, or whatever, a change in theme, all the love letter games. You know, you might just change one rule or just try to remember things thematically, so you're often going to get things wrong. And I think that's where people get caught up sometimes, is they're worrying about that first play. Now, it totally makes sense, because a first impression of a game is so important. I see it all the time with, you know, people that I invite over who are not, you know, gaming enthusiasts. And if you don't give them the right game for the first play, we're so nervous they're going to be out. And so when we suggest a game to people, or I've let people borrow a game, been like, oh, the rule book's really easy, you know, a Patchwork or a Seven Wonders Duel. And they can't get through the barrier of that rule book. And so they're unable to play and enjoy the hobby that we all love. And so it makes sense where we really want to worry about that first play. But we just got to realize that you're going to get things wrong the first time. And so I find that most rule books really are good. They work out well. Things are in there. Clarifications are in there. Now, one of the issues is it's not always in the order that I would put it in. You know, when I read a lot of rule books, often I don't have the game in front of me. I like to have the game in front of me. I like to move the pieces. I don't even think that's, like one way that people learn. I think everybody learns by manipulating the pieces. That's just normal. It's kind of like if I played a video game or the tutorial was just reading about the video game. Like obviously in a video game, when you do the tutorial, you play the game. They get you to click the buttons. They get you to do things. Everybody learns better that way. So I like that, but often I'm reading the rule book. So I usually skip like setup. I'll reference the, contents of the game. Like what are all the parts and pieces and everything, components, so that I know what they're talking about. But I get straight into the, like, how do the actions, how does this game look? Often that helps me understand setup. That helps me understand game end game. So I like the, how does the turn all go out? Now, in a rule book, setup should absolutely be first and component list and all that. I suppose a component list could be in the back, but it generally makes sense and it's fine. So, I find that most things are there and it works out. It's just not always in the order that I would put things in. Recently, I was reading one and it gave the whole setup, and then you have to put your starting piece on the board. And you go through all how to play the game, and then it finally gets to, this is where the first round is, and this is how you end a turn, and it tells you, oh, in the first round, you're going to put your piece out on the board. I would like to have had that up front as part of setup, but it was in there. I think that's another thing that happens sometimes is, you know, depending on the situation, if we're reading a rule book and trying to play the game right then and there, I think that can be tricky, or just everything's not presented in the same manner. So rule book is kind of like a book. You have to read the whole thing and you'll eventually get all the information. Now, in a movie or in a show or other, in a song, you know, often we like to do that creatively. Like, you know, I think of Memento, where the movie goes backward and forward. And that's just a creative element, and then we get to kind of experience that ride and understand it. Now that's, you know, for our enjoyment to take in. A rule book is a technical manual. And so you want to explain things to people in the most logical way, not the most illogical way that, you know, gives them pleasure from reading or whatever. It's a little bit different in that front, so I understand there. But that's one element, I think. You know, we don't always get through the whole rule book, so these rules are at the end, or they're under clarifications, but I wanted clarifications in the margins. I think clarifications in the margins are better, but the information is in the rule book. Now, the other part I want to comment here is from my teaching perspective. So as somebody who is, I'm a math teacher, public school math teacher, high school math, and, you know, I have to explain all sorts of complex things, algebra, statistics, calculus, pre-calculus, trigonometry, geometry, all sorts of different types of functions, and I have to break all this down. And what I can tell you from having 1,500, 2,000 students, something like that in my career, is that there is no possible way that everybody learns the same topic the same way. And Better yet, there's no perfect formula for teaching anything. I may teach a group of students one way and the next year switch it up and try to teach a different way. Or my early in the day class, I may explain it and everybody looks at me like, great job, thanks so much, have a good day, we understood it 100%. And then my next class gets me and they're just looking at me like, we have no idea what you're talking about. And it made perfect sense to group A and I loved it, but group B is like, we have no idea. And so really a key skill is to be able to rephrase things, reword things, and explain them in a different way. I don't know that we always want rule books to do that. So I would imagine, I'm not a rule book editor, I'm not a writer, I imagine there's a kind of best practice for doing that. There's a way to lay that out that most people would agree is the best way. But I certainly know that people just aren't going to learn that way. I know that there are people that just aren't going to pick up a rule book and learn a game that way. They're going to go watch Rodney Smith or Paul Grogan or Heavy Cardboard, and they're going to do it that way. They're going to watch a John Getz Games playthrough, and they're going to learn that way, or a Rotto video. That's going to be their best way for learning the game. Other people are going to say, just teach me. I don't want to know. Just teach me the games, you know? I'm not going to read the rule book. Show me what to do, and I'll do that. I think that, for the most part, is Kathy. She would say she's super happy for me to just read and teach. And I feel like I have a fair amount of success. I always try to be careful. I don't want to pat myself on the back too much, but I enjoy teaching people. And so I find the joy in like, oh yeah, you're understanding what to do in this game. Even if I don't enjoy the game itself, when people are understanding how to play the game, I love that. Or if somebody says, oh, can you learn and teach me this game? That's really exciting for me. Even if I end up despising the game, it probably wasn't that exciting. But if the game was mediocre to me, but they were really happy they got to play it, I enjoy that a whole bunch. But I think that's really key, is that people just are not going to learn the same way. And so I think it's awesome that we can have multiple outlets in order to teach games, that rulebook can be one of those. Now, I understand as the hobby expands and grows, it's just not going to be that everybody's going to know about all these things and have access. And so we're going to hand these rule books off. And by no means am I saying that there are not bad rule books. There are bad rule books. Ironically, I am reading a bad rule book right now. It's just hard to parse everything out. It jumps from information in the rule book to reference cards and all over the map. And it's hard to follow. But generally, I can still figure out a game. Now, where it can be frustrating is if there's a really key rule that's just not there, or just not well explained, or I'll have a hang-up often, more if I'm playing in a group or teaching at a convention or something like that, or, oh, heaven forbid, running a tournament for a game, which I just think is the biggest nightmare, where there is somebody who just needs to know. They need to know this one outlier case must be a certain way, that's how everything's going to go. And that can be really tough, because they can just be hung up. Nope, we're not moving on until I figure this out. Or I'm trying to find the rule, but trying to keep the game going and keep everybody interested, but it's just not going to happen. And yeah, tournaments can really get crazy, because I'll just make a ruling in a tournament, because to me, most tournaments that I run things for or have run are just meant to be fun, but people are just, it's life or death if this card means and or whatever, I don't know. And it's just not as big a deal to me. Getting the rules right is a big deal, for sure. But even on a first play, I'm like, I don't know, let's play it this way and see afterward. Now, if I start making up 10, 11, 12 rules, then it gets to be a little much. But 2, 3, 4 within a game, I'll make note of them and look them up. Or, you know, if people don't mind, I generally don't like to be on my phone, but we'll, you know, look it up as we're going and try to correct if we can. Depending on how far we get through a game, if we get a rule wrong, like one or two rounds in, we'll usually correct. But if we're 7 or 8 rounds in, we'll usually finish the game with the wrong rule to keep it the same for everybody. Which, of course, can give a bad impression of a game because you played a rule wrong and whatnot. So then the other big thing is there's like a rule book system. There's 2 rule books versus 1 rule book. You'll see both of those and which is better and which one is more interesting to do. And I don't know that I have a preference on that front. I like the generally FFG 2 rulebook system, or even the old Z-Man games would give you like the rulebook and then the like reference for all the tiles in the game or all the cards. And it's nice to have that reference that can kind of be passed around the table while somebody else is looking for the rulebook. The only part that's a little weird with the FFG is they very much are like learn to play and reference, and the end of the learn to play is like, and here's all the advanced clarifications and mechanisms that we didn't describe to you. And I generally want to play with all those things the first time. So, you know, I really like to break out a game and learn it myself before I teach it. I'm not a huge crack the game open, start reading the rule book. I don't like getting things wrong, and so I like to generally know the game. And just sitting there trying to figure it out, I don't find as exciting. You know, there's some smaller games where it's not a big deal. You know, a family weight game or something where I'll read the rules. If it's four pages, I'll read it there and we'll figure it out. And obviously conventions and things, doing a lot of that. So the 2-1 rulebook isn't really a big deal to me. I don't mind, and I think FFG does a really good job with their rulebooks. I mean, they're thoroughly edited. They sometimes had more issues in the past with balance of their game than is the rule are the rules well explained. You know, examples, and they make beautiful rulebooks. I mean, there are some companies that really go over the top. Now, step back for a second. Editing rulebooks, having people blind testing rules, all that stuff I think is essentially vital. And so can people do better with the rule books? Absolutely. Can gamers get by with the rule books we already have? Generally. Now, I know there's going to be a lot more people out there who have gotten a Kickstarter game or a preview copy or a prototype or even smaller publisher with the pamphlet style rules that are terrible. I don't come across that as much. I pretty much play fully published games and probably from bigger companies, and they have their fair share of bad rule books. But generally I find if I read through everything, I can have it all there. But I definitely think there's space in the gaming hobby for more full-time rule book editors, more opportunity to blind play test. I know right now the big thing is like, we are releasing 3,000 to 6,000 games a year. How can people play all those? Maybe part of the step back we can take is let's cut that down to 2,000 or 3,000, but have solid rule books for these games. So some of these games that are getting passed over, people aren't understanding, you know, how to play as much. And I think that would be really good in terms of that. So I definitely think we could publish less and do better with those rule books. But I haven't come across so many that are terrible and awful, and I certainly have. I think really what would benefit people the most are player aids. So game I'm looking at in front of me has got 2 rule book size, you know, square Ticket to Ride size cardboard player aids. And that's great, but it's a 4-player game. So you can pass this around, but why are there not 4 in the box? I don't understand. I think a lot of games, you know, big board style games could benefit from having the actions and the turn order or round, you know, phases of play, whatever, on the board itself for everybody to reference. I know Pandemic does that and tells you what to do, and lots of games do. I think that could benefit. And now, space is going to be an issue, and depending on the game, I understand where that's going to be. Think of something like Lisboa. Lisboa gives every player a booklet and then explains all the tiles in there, so everybody has that reference. I think those kind of things, giving individual players the power so that the person who's reading and explaining the game isn't solely responsible for every rule, everything, and then this one giant rule book that has to be passed around. I think player aids would alleviate a ton of this. Now, it's more to the publisher, more costs, more things to do. But I think it's okay. I think that's okay to ask of people. You know, hey, edit your rule books. Blind playtest them. Give them to people who've never played the game and have them do that. I'd love to do that for a publishing company, to tell a publisher, to tell the truth. I'd love to take games that are almost ready to go and play them and say, this was confusing, this, we got this wrong, you know, whatever. I'd video myself playing it. I think that would be fun, more than playing a prototype and being like, I was the first to play this game when it was little pieces of paper and all that. But again, I think player aids are really what people would most desire. I think that would cut down on a lot of it. Now, what you're going to put on a player aid, I don't know, and what size you want to make it, and what quality you want to make it, I'm not sure. But I don't know that I need all the end game scoring. That, to me, could be on the back of a rule book, or even a lot of companies do the phases of the game on the back of the rule book, which is really nice. And the end game scoring could be there. There's some games where probably the end game scoring is everything, or it's shorter, and there's a bunch of things. So it's good to know all that end game scoring, because what I'm going to score at the end is very particular, and I need to know it throughout the game. But there's a lot where I don't. And I don't care if it's on a play rate or a single card that could be passed around would be fine with me. But the phases of the game, all my actions, what resources exchange for what, whatever extra little things I could do. I think if all that's on there, I think that would alleviate a lot of this stress, because the rule book needs to be good. I need to be able to learn the game from the rule book. But then I don't really want to reference the rule book. I don't want to be passing this around and looking up things. So give me smaller bits, even a player aid where I can go back and be like, oh, I remember this game. Here's all the phases, I think is really nice. There's no cookie cutter one size fits all solution. It's just not going to happen for games. Like I said, people are going to learn different ways. A big, giant, interactive Amerithrash, trash, whatever style game is going to have so many more fiddly rules, I can't player aid that. And a little, box game is going to have so few, it's not going to be a big deal. So on that front, there's not going to be a perfect solution to what it is. But I know there's people out there who do a great job with this, who do this full time, and or want to do this full time, and I think giving them that opportunity would be awesome. So yes, we have improvement for rule books. Finding a lot that are really good as well, though, I think is important. There isn't going to be a perfect solution to how to write a rule book, because people are just going to learn different ways. But I'm excited that there's people thinking about this. And I think pushing ourselves and saying, we're not happy with where we are, let's get better. And if the whole industry can do that, wow, that's going to be awesome. That's going to be a great spot to be in. So I am excited for that front. I'm excited that we are moving forward and whatnot. I think with that, we're going to bring episode 88 to a close. So thank you so much, everybody. Thanks for listening. Hopefully we will see you around, see you at one of the conventions, see you at the store. Any of those things would be awesome. I'm just really excited for convention season to get going. I guess for me, it's not really till July, but I'm excited to hear about Origins and all the things that are happening, and whatnot. So that is it, everybody. Episode 88. Together we can rule the galaxy. Again, Emperor. Days later, still did the Emperor instead of Vader. Oh, well. C'est la vie. Alrighty, everybody. I am your host, The Brant, and I hope you step into the portal. Portal Game Podcast is a product of Time Machine Toy and Hobby Store / The Portal, which is located at 71 and 60 Hilliard Street in Manchester, Connecticut. This episode was recorded on May 19th and May 17th, 2018. Please send any questions to us at portalgamingpodcast@gmail.com. Portal Game Podcast is a proud member of the Dice Tower Network. For more awesome podcasts, visit www.dicetowernetwork.com. Hey, thanks for listening.